High Bridge, a division of Recorded Books, presents How to Sleep Well, the Science of Sleeping Smarter, Living Better, and Being Productive, by Dr. Neil Stanley. Read by B.J. Harrison. About the author. I started my career in sleep in 1982 at the age of 16, when I got a job in the Neurosciences Division of the RAF Institute of Aviation Medicine, or IAM, in Farnborough, Hampshire. At the time, the RAF were interested in sleep because of issues such as jet lag, aircrew workload, shift work, and medicines that could positively or negatively affect sleep. When I joined the IAM, it had a 3-bed sleep laboratory, although over the years this increased to 6. During my time at IAM, I was involved in numerous research studies, the most notable of which was my participation in a medical expedition to Pakistan, where my colleagues and I recorded sleep in 8 people for 6 nights at 18,500 feet, or 5,400 meters, in the Karakoram Mountains. In 1993, I took a position at the Human Psychopharmacology Research Unit, or HPRU, part of the University of Surrey, where I eventually became Director of Sleep Research. At the HPRU, I created and ran a 24-bed trials sleep laboratory, primarily designed for clinical trials into the effects of medications on sleep. I received my PhD from the University of Surrey on the basis of my published works in 2004. I have published 38 peer-review papers on various aspects of sleep research and psychopharmacology, and I have presented my research to numerous national and international scientific and medical societies. I am a member of the following professional bodies: European Sleep Research Society, American Academy of Sleep Medicine, British Sleep Society, Chairman from 2000 to 2004, Committee Member from 1998 to 2000, European Society of Sleep Technologists. I was member of the Executive Committee of the Assembly of National Sleep Societies from 2004 to 2009, and through that, I am a co-author of the Guidelines for Accreditation of Sleep Medicine Centers, Guidelines for Sleep Medicine Education in Europe, and Standard Procedures for Adult Sleep Medicine. In addition to setting up a clinical sleep service at the HPRU, I was also involved, on a freelance basis, in setting up and developing the sleep service at the London Clinic. I have also worked freelance for ScanSleep in Copenhagen and the Lovisenberg Hospital in Oslo. I now spend most of my time writing about sleep and traveling worldwide, lecturing on the benefits of good sleep to both healthcare professionals and members of the public. I am widely quoted by the UK and international media as a sleep expert. Since 1982, I have spent much of my life watching other people sleep, which, when I write it down, does sound rather sinister. Sleep is my life. It's what I do. If I am not talking about sleep, I am writing about sleep. If I am not writing about sleep, I am reading about sleep. If I am not reading about sleep, I am probably asleep. For more information, see thesleepconsultancy.com. My sleep. I think that it is only right, if I am going to give advice about sleep, that you should at least know if I practice what I preach. So here is a brief description of my sleep environment and habits. I sleep in a 6-foot Super King Vispring Shetland Superb bed. The bed is dressed with pure wool, long continental single duvets, and pure cotton bed linen. I ordinarily sleep in a separate bedroom from my partner. I use 2 down and feather pillows. I wear cotton pajamas. I always sleep with a window open, however cold it is outside. I do not have the heating on overnight in the bedroom. I do not have a TV, computer, or a radio in my bedroom. I always read a proper paper book before lights out. I am very much a morning person, so if I wake up early, I will get up. If I wake in the middle of the night, I will usually switch the bedside light on and read for 10 to 60 minutes. I feel I need 9 to 9.5 hours sleep a night to be at my best. I have a pretty regular routine when I am at home. I usually go to bed between 9:30 and 10:30 p.m., and awake and get up at 6 to 6:30 a.m., even at the weekends. I do snore sometimes, usually after alcohol, but also because I carry a bit more weight than perhaps I should. I do not exercise in the evening. To be honest, I don't actually do much exercise at any time. I do not eat too late at night. I do not avoid caffeine or moderate alcohol in the evening. I sometimes, but not often, have a couple of beers or a couple of glasses of wine in the evening. I have paper and pen next to my bed to write down worries or thoughts that occur to me during the night. As a child, I did not have any particular sleep problems. Important note: I am not medically qualified. However, I have spent all my adult life researching sleep. My advice is based on my research, my experience, my reading of the relevant scientific and popular literature on the subject, and a lifelong interest in the subject of sleep. My advice is in no way intended to replace medical opinion, and I must stress that if you are in any way worried about problems you, your partner, or your child are having with sleep, or if you have medical problems or are taking any treatments that disturb your sleep, you should always see your general practitioner, as only they, in the full knowledge of your medical history, can recommend an appropriate course of action. Introduction. Sleep well, live better. Many of us have a problem with everyday poor sleep, low-grade exhaustion, and sleepiness during the day that most of us experience on more or less a regular basis. A few years ago, I coined the term semisomnia to describe the phenomena, but alas, it never really caught on. To illustrate this point, honestly answer the question, how do you feel during the day on a scale of 0 to 10, where 0 is that you have an irresistible desire to fall asleep, and 10, you are the most awake you have ever been. Now, I can pretty much bet that none of you are a 10, but what is perhaps more worrying is that I also doubt that many of you are a 9 or 8. I know some of you think you are very awake, but this is probably because you have fooled yourself into believing this in order to get you through the day. Honestly, look at how you feel. Is this really the best you could be? If so, I would suggest a lifestyle change. Because you don't feel good during the day, you spend time, and indeed money, on trying to feel better. The multivitamin pill to supposedly keep you healthy, the cup of coffee to get you going, the chocolate bar as a treat because you don't feel good, the energy pill or drink to give you a boost during the day, the glass of wine to help you relax. At the end of the week, you treat yourself to a spa treatment, and you cannot wait for the holiday, when you can finally chill out. Just imagine how much better life could be, and how much more productive you would be, if each day you were at your best. So, why are you going through each day at less than your full potential? The most likely explanation is because you are not sleeping well. Simply getting better sleep will make you feel better each and every day. Sleeping better tonight will make you feel better tomorrow. Getting better sleep tomorrow night will make you feel better the next day, and so on. And let's not forget that good sleep can also be one of our greatest pleasures. For sleep is that golden chain that ties health and our bodies together. Thomas Dekker, 1609. So, how to sleep better? As parents, we ensure our children wind down before bedtime. Bath, story, lullaby, bed. Because we know it works. But what is true for children also holds true for adults. It's just that in our busy lives, we seem to forget the basics. But really, how hard can it be? Imagine putting your children to bed, spending a few hours with your partner, and then running yourself a nice warm bath with your favorite bubbles, candles, nice music playing in the background, and maybe a small glass of wine. You luxuriate in the bath, soaking away all the cares and worries of the day. Then, just as it starts to cool, you get out, put on a big, fluffy, toweling robe, and then get into a bed that has been freshly made. That would work, wouldn't it? So why don't you do it? Imagine your partner is upstairs in the bath. You are sitting in your candle-lit drawing room, comfortable, in your leather, button-back armchair, wearing your velvet smoking jacket, a fire burning in the grate, your faithful hounds asleep at your feet, a generous measure of a fine single malt in a lead crystal glass in one hand, and a large Havana cigar in the other. Okay, maybe not everyone's idea of an ideal end of the day, but admit it, it comes close. Getting better sleep should not be a chore or an inconvenience. It should be something we choose to do, something we want to do, and something that can be very pleasurable to do. Prologue. The end of the world is nigh. Our ancestors were using fire for heat, protection, and light between 300,000 and 400,000 years ago, before Homo sapiens evolved. Thus, for our entire history, we have not been slaves to going to sleep with the rising and setting of the sun. The idea that this only happened recently, because of Edison and his light bulb, is frankly ridiculous. The oldest evidence for something that specifically functioned as a bed dates back at least 77,000 years. Approximately 10,000 years ago, we started building substantial structures, first in wood and later of stone, as our houses. Then, about the same time we stopped believing in ghosts, witches, and the devil, we started putting glass windows in our humble abodes. All these trappings of civilization mean that we now sleep in an environment where there is a low risk from pathogens, we and our livestock are safe from predators and our enemies, we are dry and warm, without the need to tend the fire, we sleep privately, with at most one other person, with little, if any, body contact. Our bedrooms are quiet, dark, fresh-smelling, with access to clean, fresh air. We sleep in a comfortable bed with clean, dry bedding, free from biting parasites. We are secure behind locked and alarmed doors and windows, so we no longer need someone to remain on watch or be woken by our guard dogs. The 8-hour day and working time directives exist to ensure we have adequate time for sleep. Computers and robots are promised to allow us to work even less. These should be halcyon days for sleep. However, it has been claimed that we are actually living in the midst of a catastrophic sleep loss epidemic, which is having a catastrophic impact on our health, our life expectancy, our safety, and our productivity. Furthermore, claims are made that virtually every major disease is said to be linked to sleep loss, and this lack of sleep is perhaps the greatest curable disease in the world right now. Scary stuff, I think you will agree. But is it actually true? Well, the first issue with this idea is one of definition, because it is not clear as to what the research is actually referring to when they talk about poor or insufficient or short sleep. Is it people who naturally only need less than 6 hours sleep a night? That is, they have a genetic disposition to short sleep? Or is it someone who only sleeps less than 6 hours and by doing so is getting less sleep than their genetics dictate? These are two different things. The first person cannot change, nor can the risk of any negative effects, whereas the second person can and probably should change. Are we really in the midst of a sleep loss epidemic, catastrophic or otherwise? Despite what is claimed, there is actually very little reliable data about how we slept during the last 100 years, and absolutely none from before that time. In light of all the recent scaremongering, it is hard to believe that there is actually very little evidence to support the assertion that adult sleep duration has decreased in recent decades. In a review of data from 15 countries from the 1960s until the 2000s, self-reported average sleep duration of adults was found to have actually increased in 7 countries: Bulgaria, Poland, Canada, France, Britain, Korea, and the Netherlands. Range, 0.1 to 1.7 minutes per night each year. And decreased in 6 countries: Japan, Russia, Finland, Germany, Belgium, and Austria. But only about 0.1 to 0.6 minutes per night each year. Inconsistent results were found for the United States and Sweden. There was no clear social or economic grouping of the countries that might explain the diverse trends. So even where there has been a decrease in sleep duration, it could hardly be considered catastrophic. A further study of data from 10 developed countries found that instead of the anticipated increase in short sleep, longer sleep durations had become more common across these nations. Short sleep had increased only in Italy and Norway, but had decreased in Sweden, the United Kingdom, and the United States. Long sleep had increased in Australia, Finland, Sweden, the United Kingdom, and the United States, but had decreased in Canada and Italy. No changes were observed in Germany or the Netherlands. The limited increases in short sleep duration challenge the claim of increasingly sleep-deprived societies, especially as long sleep has become more widespread than short sleep, at least when reported in time-use diaries. The worldwide decline in adult sleep duration seems to have been somewhat overstated. The recent meta-analysis of objective sleep duration in healthy volunteers, as measured by polysomnography, or recording a person's brain waves and other physiological variables in order to accurately measure sleep, also demonstrated that sleep time has not declined over the past 50 years. But one might point out that the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, or CDC, states more than one-third of U.S. respondents reported typically sleeping less than 7 hours in a 24-hour period. While that may be true, it is only relevant, firstly, if you accept that fewer than 7 hours is the definition of short sleep, and secondly, if you can demonstrate using precisely the same survey methodology that there has been a change over time in the numbers of people having short sleep. Such data does not exist. Is there evidence of a catastrophic impact of poor sleep on our health, our life expectancy, our safety, and our productivity? The idea that an epidemic of insufficient sleep is a contributor to the development of major diseases, such as to Parkinson's, dementia, cancer, heart disease, obesity, diabetes, etc., rests largely on the question of whether sleep duration has declined in the last few decades. As shown, evidence to support this notion does not in fact exist, at least in healthy sleepers. Poor sleep may be associated with all of these illnesses, and doubtless many more, but a large study of middle-aged adults found that insomnia complaints did not predict an increased risk of death, nor, interestingly, did use of sleeping tablets. The suggestion that there has been a catastrophic impact of poor sleep on our life expectancy would seem hard to justify, given the steady and significant increase in life expectancy over the last 150 years or so. For instance, in the UK, data from the Office for National Statistics has shown that over the last 100 years, life expectancy at birth has increased by nearly 3 years per decade, essentially doubling since 1841. Data from a large study showed that taking 7 hours of sleep as the norm, people sleeping 6 hours had a 7% relatively greater risk of dying. This may seem to be worrying proof of the negative effects of short sleep on longevity. However, this is not the whole story. The increased risk of dying in the group having 8 hours sleep was actually 12%, and for those sleeping 9 hours, as much as 42% when compared to 7 hours. With regards to safety, figures from the Bureau of Labor Statistics in the U.S. shows that the number of non-fatal occupational injuries and illnesses per 100 full-time employees has fallen from 11 in 1973 to 2.9 in 2016. Other data from the Bureau of Labor Statistics concerning productivity shows that U.S. business sector output has increased more than ninefold since 1947, while the hours worked to produce that output have not quite doubled. Of course, there are a number of contributory factors which account for the change in these figures, but to make the argument that there has been a catastrophic effect of poor sleep seems problematic, unless you are able to show that these figures would be appreciably different if we all slept better. A survey attempted to quantify the benefit of the complete eradication of insomnia on work performance due to presenteeism. This is where you are at work but are doing nothing productive. They found that it would lead to a reduction of between 5.4% and 7.8% of work performance lost. A recent report found that a person sleeping less than 6 hours loses 6 more working days due to absenteeism or presenteeism per year than a worker sleeping 7 to 9 hours. So it is not really evident that there is a large negative impact of poor sleep, let alone one that is catastrophic. Is virtually every major disease linked to sleep loss? Poor sleep may be linked with various diseases. However, these are associations, not evidence of causation. Data from large studies mean that even a very small effect can become statistically significant, but that does not in any way mean that it is clinically relevant. For instance, data from the Sleep Heart Health Study shows that people sleeping 6 to 7 hours had a significantly higher risk of hypertension than people sleeping 7 to 8 hours. However, the difference in blood pressure between the two groups was actually very small, systolic 2.1 mmHg and diastolic 0.7 mmHg. Many of the modern-day illnesses such as Parkinson's, dementia, cancer, heart disease, are due to our longevity. We die from them because we live long enough to develop them, something we perhaps could not do if our poor sleep was having a catastrophic effect on our longevity. It is also true that for many people, sleep becomes more disturbed and potentially shorter as we get older, and the risk of developing various diseases also increase with age. However, the headline risks quoted for these diseases are nearly always given merely for adults, with no breakdown of ages. This could be important, as an increased risk of heart disease in a short-sleeping 18-year-old would be very worrying. An increased risk of heart disease in a 65-year-old short sleeper could very well be simply a consequence of aging. Coming back to the widely quoted statement from the CDC, mentioned that one-third of all Americans are sleeping less than 7 hours in a 24-hour period. This is a good headline, because it implies that this is an issue facing all Americans. The problem is that research shows that poverty, unemployment, and being African American or Latino Hispanic are the risk factors for poor sleep. And interestingly, they are also the risk factors for the majority of diseases linked to poor sleep. These populations are more prone both to an unhealthy lifestyle and to poor sleep. Doing something about poverty, unemployment, and racial inequalities would do much to lower the risk of disease and improve the sleep of the nation. Interestingly, it is rarely mentioned that, as seen in the data concerning mortality, sleeping greater than 8 hours can actually increase your risk of disease to a greater degree than short sleep, for example, the risk of developing diabetes in women. Is lack of sleep the greatest curable disease in the world right now? Malaria is curable, and according to the World Health Organization in 2016, there were an estimated 216 million cases of malaria in 91 countries, which represented an increase of 5 million cases over 2015. Malaria caused 445,000 deaths in 2016. How many people have ever actually died of lack of sleep? Who knows? But it is safe to say that lack of sleep is not the greatest curable disease in the world right now, not by a long way. It may seem petty and pedantic, but lack of sleep isn't actually a disease anyway. So why all the doom and gloom? Why, given the lack of scientific evidence, do people, including bona fide sleep experts, make such alarmist statements? Do they really believe that it is helping the public to get better sleep? Well, I may be cynical, but such statements do make great headlines, which not only result in bigger sales or increased clicks for the media outlet, but also is cheap and easy publicity for the book, app, workshop, consulting service, mattress, or whatever that is being sold in the story. Given the appetite of the media for doom and gloom, making such statements can also be a good way to get your name into the public consciousness, and this can help in securing interviews across the media, attracting speaker engagements, advisory roles for multinationals, positions on the board of startup companies, or increased research funding. For who could complain about increased research funding for something claimed to be the greatest curable disease in the world right now? There is no good thing about poor sleep. But the simple fact is that we are living longer and healthier than at any time in history. The sleep loss epidemic, if there is actually one, is perhaps not having too catastrophic an effect on our morbidity and mortality. So if we aren't sleeping less than we did in the past, is that a good thing? You don't have to worry. The end of the world is not nigh. We are not all going to die from sleep deprivation. So, can you carry on, regardless? Well, not quite. You see, I believe that it is not the quality of sleep, or indeed the quantity, that is important to us in this day and age, but our changing need for sleep. Over the years, research has shown that sleep, in particular, deep, slow-wave sleep, or SWS, plays a crucial role in our capacity to deal with the events of the day, to lay down memories, and to learn new tasks. This is important because what has undeniably changed over the last few years is the amount of information we are routinely exposed to, which we need to process during sleep. It does not matter that the vast majority of this information, the funny cat videos and the selfies, have absolutely no benefit to the development of the individual or the enrichment of society. Our brain still needs to process them, even if it is just so that we can forget it. The amount of information is quite literally mind-blowing, according to Eric Schmidt, CEO of Google, speaking in 2010. Every 2 days now, we create as much information as we did from the dawn of civilization up until 2003. It was estimated that in 2006 alone, the amount of information created was 3 million times the amount of information contained in all of the books ever written. Because of this increasing information load that has to be processed during sleep, I would argue that our need for good sleep is greater than it has ever been. Much of the stress and anxiety that we experience in the modern world is, I believe, a
sample complete. Ready to continue?